Is this just our social gang?
Right.
And it's just us? I think that's a problem.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and I am talking with Jeff Tucker. He is the director of content at the Foundation for Economic Education, which I think is the oldest,
it is.
Longest it is. Lived libertarian organization.
Crazy. Look, it was founded in 1946, right?
1946.
Which we don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
But we actually know from the history books what was going on. Price controls, you know, a heavily regulated industry. It was a wartime economy.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just at the time thought that liberalism, old liberalism, was dead and gone. But a handful of people, you know, including Lawrence Furtick and Leonard Reed, you know, and just really a small group.
And wasn't like Ludwig von Mises always hanging
well,
out
so
up there?
Well, so that's an interesting
in
thing because, he came over in 1940 and didn't really have a home.
Yeah.
Anywhere, really. He wanted to stay in New York, so he didn't have a university position. Well, Fee brought him on board, you know, and made him a kind of a house intellectual. Henry Hazlitt at the time, you know, who wrote Economics One Lesson in 1946 also. And so when I went to work for Fee, I went back because I wanted to do something about reviving his editorial mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do the same thing everybody else is doing. I wanted to do something different. And I wanted to figure out, you know, maybe there's something we're missing. So I went back and looked at the early writings of all these guys from the 1940s. And I tell you, I found something really interesting. It might be interest to you. There weren't a lot of what we call libertarians around at the time. They didn't have like we have a movement, you know? So that imposed a special editorial burden on them. They had to speak in a way to everybody or to anyone who would listen. And I think that affected the way they thought and the way they wrote. So they had to, like, every piece had to sort of make sense for anybody who happened to pick it up.
So they're in that, they're showing their math, they're making their arguments clear, they're not assuming a lot of foreknowledge.
That's right, and they're not using a specialized language,
right?
So they know better than to, and it's very different from us today.
Yeah.
But so they spoke to a general audience in the values of the time, and trying to make a practical case for human liberty.
In the early stages of Fee Publications, did they link economics to that broader issue of human liberty?
There was always a moral concern. And and it's interesting because I saw a correspondence between Ayn Rand and Leonard Reed. And she really wanted the organization to be called something like, I don't know, the Institute for the Defense of Radical Capitalism or something like that, you know. And Leonard was, you know, he came out of industry. You know, he came out of commerce. And he understood sales and marketing. And he knew that if he called it the Foundation for Economic Education, something very plain and innocuous, that they could push radical ideas in a mainstream framework.
And was it one of their early publications? I may be getting this wrong, but it was something
Stigler,
with Milton Friedman and Stigler talking about rent control.
Yes, and that was the piece that drew Murray Rothbard, my old friend, into an excited relationship with the ideas of liberty. And they did this with you know, many, many people.
Right.
Now, The height of the Freeman circulation was achieved in the 1960s with 50,000, which I mean, Reason gets that every day, and we do now. So it was a small market, relatively small market. But what I think is interesting is that they had a big job, and they had really nowhere to begin but just reaching mainstream people. And here's the thing. I think we have something to learn from that. Because as we've become a movement, that's very exciting. Mm-hmm. We love the movement.
Yeah.
And we talk as libertarians. We come to Libertarian events.
Yeah, we're at Students for Liberty, where they've got about 1,700 kids from 100 countries.
And we're all in the same Facebook groups, and we follow each other on Twitter.
Right.
And that's good. Nothing bad about that. But it does give rise to, I think, certain temptations to speak in our own vernacular or our own really high liturgical language with each other.
Right.
You know, that normal people can understand. And it also tempts us to sort of dig ever deeper into sectarian battles. And here's the other thing. It's a matter of how we think of ourselves. Are we, a chosen, marginalized group, you know, that's going to be forever, you know, hanging around together? Is this just our social gang?
Right.
And it's just us? I think that's a problem.
So what are some of the articles that you do that you try to reach a broader
I don't know if you've ever attempted to do this as an editor, but I've never done this before, never tried this before, but I try to classify every article as either in reach or outreach.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean, are we cultivating the libertarian spirit among the already convinced, or am I creating a piece of content that you as a libertarian might be willing to share in your Facebook account, even though your pastor, your mother, your friends from high school are on it, because you find it compelling enough. And what I've learned from the metrics is that this is the challenge, to create content that gets the second, third, and fourth share.
Right. What's the most recent piece you did that was successful in those terms?
Well, you mentioned my review of Young Pope.
Young Pope is the HBO show with Jude Law. And were you raised Catholic by any chance?
I'm familiar. I've had a big relationship with Catholic.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so I was raised Catholic. And I love it. I'm a prolapsed Catholic at this point. It's collapsed and it's not coming back.
You'll never be anything but an ex-Catholic. You can't get away from it.
I love the show, but talk a little bit about that piece, because that seemed to be doing something that you're talking
about. That's the kind of thing
about.
We do. We try to review all the new stuff on Netflix, and we try to write regular reviews.
Right.
In other words, I'm looking for a libertarian spin on things.
Right.
I want really regular reviews that I, as a libertarian, am going to write, because I see things different from the other people.
Right.
And I hope to add value to it, you know?
Well, you know, one of the things we used to talk about at Reason, and over the years you come up with different things, but we wanted to be we didn't want to just be a magazine for libertarians. We wanted to be a magazine by libertarians, because your worldview would fill out.
I think that's a good way to think about it. Reason does a good job.
What was your insight for the Young Pope? Because I thought it was kind of clever.
I think the whole thing was structured in a way to respond to the rise of a kind of a reactionary right, you know, in Europe and in the United States. And this show is very popular in Italy. So a young pope shows up. He had a regular career. He had the perfect bishop career. Just the right training and never revealed much about himself, just very pastoral, as they say. They knew he was a conservative because, of course, look at his teachers and look at his temperament and that sort of thing. What they didn't know is that he had a hard agenda and really a revanchist agenda to recapture what had been lost. And he really does adopt all these forms that are essentially pre-Vatican II, you know. And there are moments in the thing that just had me just cracking up, you know. He delayed weeks his opening lecture to the
College Cardinals.
And by the final thing, the thing comes along, he's carried in,
you know,
on a chair
and
wearing the most outrageous liturgical gear, seeming to revive the temporal power. Oh, and he brings back the Triple Crown, you know, which
That's
Paul
right.
VI gave away. He gets a ship from Washington.
But and then at the same time, he is hyper-conservative or traditional,
right.
but he breaks all the forms. He even starts smoking again
in
the Vatican,
right.
which is...
And also, you know, I thought it was very interesting for me to follow it, because his commitment was entirely intellectual, but it wasn't organically connected with the real experience of the church now.
Yeah.
And what he finds is that there's no going back, which is not to say that it's inevitable. We're going to forever tend in Francis' direction. The point is that whatever you're going to build, you have to build from what actually really exists.
Well, and you also talked about it, how the Young Pope, and again, this is a show that was filmed in Italy a year or a year and a half ago, so it's pre-Trump, but he's also kind of the one way to talk about Trump, because he has a very strong set of views that he is going to force on people.
That's right.
Whether he likes it
or
not.
People resist.
I read reviews of things partly because I'm dodging my own deadlines, but it's also like I had a professor once who said, look, any criticism is good if it makes the thing more interesting. And I thought that your Young Pope piece worked really well.
Now, had you seen it?
Yeah.
And you still like my review.
Oh, totally. Yeah,
and it gave you some insight, right?
Yeah, no, and it also made me think about Trump. You know, who I am. I'm not a fan of Trump. One of the things, though, I do find attractive about him is his willingness to break with decorum and just be like, shut the fuck up. Like, we're doing it my way now.
And
he will say, this is the way it should always be done. And that is... It's chaos-inducing, I think it is, not
principle.
Maybe
we need that.
But it can make an opening for a more radical politics.
I hope that's true. You know, on the other side, we had a review of this movie about Queen Elizabeth II, The Crown.
Yep.
And now there you have an opposite case, you know, because you have somebody who's a similar leader, but she throws away her personality, her personal desires, her own individual wishes and everything, out of deference to the long tradition.
Right.
And in a way, The Crown makes the case that there's merit in that, too.
Right.
Because the disturbance itself can create, you know, an atmosphere in which bad things can happen. She wants to defer to the past. And, right. and in fact, in the previous generation, you know, they had the king that renounced his...
Oh, yeah.
You know, Edward. For the sake of love, you know.
Yeah,
and the monarchy was like, don't ever do anything like that, because that's not what the people need. We need... Right. But that show makes the case for more of a continuity right. or a slow change. I think we as libertarians... You know, are drawn to both. Part of us wants to disturb yeah. and upset and overthrow.
Well, and
part
this
of us is also a little concerned about
yeah,
that.
This we have the difference between a kind of like Rothbard and Hayek, perhaps.
I think
or something.
That the difference between Rothbard and Hayek is very interesting.
Yeah.
And I think all good libertarians toggle between
right.
Hayek and Rothbard.
Well, we will stop it here. But what I want to congratulate you on, because this is on really revitalizing Fee, and
it's
I mean
well.
The material is good. This opens up a way of talking about libertarianism as well as ideas, as well as current popular culture in ways that are just, it's very, very generative.
Liberty is everything, and it belongs to everybody. And we should speak to everybody, I think, and not think of ourselves as a small sect, but,
certainly,
as Mises said, for the common good for everybody.
We've been talking with Jeff Tucker. He is the director of content at the Foundation for Economic Education, fee.org. Jeff, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.